I'm using techniques and skills specific to handmade footwear as a way to translate my experience in life and relate architecture to craft skills to reinvent how we transfer craft knowledge, because I really think that that connection to making is part of the solution. And I might not have it, but I'm a keeper of knowledge that might have the key for someone else to figure it out.
ShoeCast! Welcome to the Stitchdown ShoeCast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things we love about it. I'm Ben from Stitchdown.com, and today I am absolutely delighted to be chatting with Sarah Madeline Tierney Guerin, who is a Western bootmaker under her moniker Saboteuz, but really also approximately 1,000,002, I guess, other things, including, for a short list, an artist, a historian, an educator, a storyteller, preservationist, someone who just thinks about all this shit differently, and quite possibly the person who knows the most about the deep history of Massachusetts shoemaking anywhere, as far as I can tell. God, we're going to get into so much today, but first I need to give a special ShoeCast shout out to our sponsor this week, Standard and Strange, Rolling Dub Trio, Attractions, Y2 Leather, The Real McCoys, Lofgren, and of course, Clinch. There's a Japanese boot you're interested in. SNS is most likely a fantastic place to find it. Hop on their very informative newsletter for updates at standardandstrange.com. Also, if you are the kind of person who enjoys engaging in 24/7 discussions with people who also care entirely too much about great shoes and boots and leather and all of it, while also supporting this humble podcast, we'd love if you considered a membership to the Stitchdown Premium Discord, the greatest place on the internet for all of that. More information at stitchdown.com. I promise you'll love it. All right, let's get down to it. Sarah, welcome to the ShoeCast. How is everything and what are you wearing on your feet today?
Thanks for having me, Ben. I am wearing some Brancourt hand-sewn moccasins because I'm in my home and I always wear them in the home. And it's especially timely since they are in Lewiston, Maine, considering what we're undergoing right now. But they're one of the few companies that still are making shoes and boots and slippers using old techniques. And I like to support local if I can.
Yeah, love everything about Rancourt. This probably won't air too close to the horrific happenings up in Lewiston, but I hope that it's frankly still on everybody's mind at that point, because it sometimes seems like that doesn't last for too long. I just got in touch with everybody that I know from that industry up there that night, because I saw it on Twitter. It's like, is everybody okay? I mean, one of the shoemakers hangs out at the bar, and like they couldn't find him that night and found out that next morning that he was okay. But I don't know. Crazy. Absolutely. So switching topics. First off, thank you so much for coming to our bootcamp event in New York in October. It was fantastic to meet you and just learn about you. And obviously we felt the need to do it plenty more, which is what led us here today. So thank you. Thank you for coming and grabbing me as I was sprinting around. And I'm thrilled that that happened and that we're doing this right now.
Yeah, I am too. It was really great for me to be able to drive down there. You know, it's only about 4 to 5 hours away. So I was happy to be able to go to a footwear event because often they're pretty far from me.
God, we have so much to cover. It's honestly kind of intimidating. But let's start with what might be an easy one. You work under the kind of brand, I mean, I think we could call it, but also it seems kind of like the nom de shoe, Saboteuz, which I think I'm getting. We went over that extensively before the show started.
You had it better the first time, but that's good. Being a French and English speaker, I thought it would be easy for people, but you know, shame on me.
I'm barely either of those. What does that mean? Let's start there.
So it's the female version of saboteur in French, which we only have the male version in English. We've taken that word. So I figured everybody knows what saboteur is, and this is the female version because you have gendered words in French. So there are word etymologists who know more than I do, but there are different stories of where this particular word derived from. But one of the stories, which I loved, was that in that time of transition from artisan making to factory work or mill work with water wheels, that these farmers who and artisans who worked at home who wore these big wooden shoes that are called sabots in French were coming and throwing them into the cogs and gears and works of the factories in order to stop the work and stop their livelihoods being destroyed by this early version of mass production. And so that's where the word sabotage came, you know, throwing your wrench into the gears. And I loved this idea. And I also like the idea of artists who had a name that became a symbol of a larger body of work and not just the one person doing it. So right in the beginning, when I started bootmaking and having this idea that I was going to have an art studio, bootmaking studio, I needed a name to start with. And that's where I went.
I love the connection, and I didn't know any of that. So thank you for schooling me. Do you consider yourself to be a saboteur?
I do, in a academic sense and a practicing sense. And it's not that making shoes or boots by hand, even if you're a singular person doing it as part of a movement, is really going to break down the systems of mass production that happen on a global scale now. But I do think that all the components of my practice that include lecturing to the public and doing demonstrations and talking to children and talking to different people about our history and how shoes are made, how they can be made, intent to repair, all these things that we love about footwear, that will plant a seed somewhere that will disrupt the system, because it's unsustainable, the global footwear production we have now. So that's my throwing of the shoe into the cogs. And by my daily practice of making things by hand is also a resistance to these systems.
So how did you learn how to do that? How did you become the person who could consider themselves to be this disruptor? You need to be able to make boots by hand. How'd that happen?
I started in art school. I really did want to make shoes, but I couldn't have articulated it that way. I love shoes the way we all love shoes. I loved wearing them. I love collecting them. And I am a maker, so I was making things constantly. And I really was amazed at how complicated shoes were on my own, and then part of art school classes. And just in general, I would be deconstructing shoes, trying to put them back together, making my own, being inspired by Chopin's or Japanese Gaita or something. I would make my own versions and learn through making, and didn't know that a shoemaker was something that one could be. And that's part of this disconnect that I try to heal all the time with my historical research and talking to people about the history and why it's important, is because we're so divorced from it. As Americans, I don't want to speak for other countries, but certainly as Americans, we don't really know, the common person, how the shoes that are on our feet were made, who made them, the conditions of their labor, the materials, how they were produced, the impact. Whereas at a time we did, just by a closer connection to the craft and the trade. And we're so far from it that we just don't even think about it anymore. I think most people go through life without thinking about it. So I certainly did not know that was something you could do when I was 19 years old, in college, in an art school, in a design school, where the only type of footwear making that was considered in this entire school, which was one of the most esteemed art and design schools in the country, had a sneaker design course where you were drawing in 2D. There wasn't even really making in that. And it was in the major of industrial design, which nobody who was not in industrial design could access. That is not the case there now. So we have already in 25 years made a move toward relating making to design and considering some of these issues that were not being considered then. But I had the good fortune of being in the architecture building that was right across the street from a fine clothier. And he was a cigar smoker. His name was Briggs Doherty, and he was a huge personality in Providence. And he would stand out on his corner talking about cars with anybody who wanted to walk by, because he loved cars and always had a really cool one out in front, and smoking cigars. And he was just chatting me up on the corner and said, if you could do anything, what would you do right now? It's one of those moments that stands out, because I wasn't walking around saying, I want to be a shoemaker. But when somebody asked me, and I'm in an architecture program, so ostensibly training to be an architect someday, I said, I want to be a shoemaker. I'd be a shoemaker right now. And he went in his shop, came out, gave me a handwritten ballpoint pen phone number and said, call this guy. And it was Perry Ercolino, who's a shoemaker in Pennsylvania. And he was doing trunk shows through this fancy clothing, like nice, fine men's clothing place. And I called him and talked to him for about an hour. And he essentially told me that I couldn't do it, that it can't happen. It's impossible in this country because we don't have any systems in place for learning the skills, that it's incredibly complicated. He had learned, I think, from his dad or his grandfather. And he said, and even if you can, I make loafers that cost thousands of dollars and I can't make a living at this. This is a pipe dream. Good luck to you. he was really lovely. He wasn't trying to be discouraging. He was really informative and just told me about his life. And I think at the time, I don't know what he does now, but he had a cobbler shop as well. So he was making a living at that and then passionately making shoes and for trunk shows in the back. He essentially showed me that if he's doing it, I can do it. I'm a quite determined person. So even if he said, you can't do that, I'm like, okay, if he found a way, even if it was through his family, I can find a way. It was always in my mind, this is something I want to do. I just don't know how to do it. And that is part of the issue in our country, that we have no structural support in any way for footwear making, learning the skills of footwear making anymore. This is a really long-winded way of saying I went to art school, architecture and design school, of which I use all the time in my boot making, the same principles. I discovered that there was a school in England called Cordwainers College that London College of Fashion had recently taken over in the early 2000s. And I went and did their program, which was kind of a summer-long abbreviated version of the one-year program they offer, and learned pattern making and last concepts and how industry shoes are made. At that place, I learned what I really want to be doing, this handmaking, was not something that you went to a school to learn, but something that you learned through an apprenticeship system now. They were like, good luck, go home and find a shoemaker to learn what you want to learn. And I had to come back to the Boston area because I had two small kids who have a life and my life was here. And there were no makers here anymore. There were just none. And I knew Alden was there, but that wasn't really what I wanted to do either. You know, they're probably an hour from me. The Boston Globe did a story on a Western bootmaker who had moved from Colorado to Massachusetts around that time. And I went out and talked to him, and he is the one who taught me. He taught me in a training apprenticeship type one-on-one relationship over a three-year period. So that's how I ended up being a Western bootmaker.
Who was that?
His name's Jim Covington. His bootmaking brand was Jimmy Luke Covington. He learned from Ed Martin, who I think was originally from Amarillo, Texas. So while he learned in Colorado, he was part of this Texas lineage. And he had also learned from Randy Merrill.
No way.
Who has the best role in this kind of cyclical circle of knowledge that I like to talk about. So the last school, if you did look at schooling and institutionalized instruction for learning shoemaking in the United States, one of the last big formal schools was in Lynn, Massachusetts, which is just north of Boston and a former footwear making hub. It was called Independent Industrial Shoemaking School, and it closed in the 1974-1975 class, and Randy was in that class. So he had come to Lynn from Utah, where he's from, to learn shoemaking. He went back to Utah, and he teamed up with two guys, I think from New Hampshire, who formed Merrill Footwear and did really well. And he ended up in the mid-80s leaving that company and teaching and making hiking boots and Western boots and bespoke boots by hand, and then teaching people in Vernal, Utah, where he still is. He teaches Jim decades later, and then Jim ends up in Massachusetts because he happened to marry somebody from Massachusetts. So at the time Jim moved to Massachusetts, nobody really was doing professional handmade footwear as a job the way Jim did it. And he comes back and ends up teaching those skills, which if you could trace knowledge, trace back to Randy and then back to Lynn, to me, who is from Lynn. Swampscott, the small town next door where I grew up, and had no idea of this history, even at this point in time. It's so gone. It's such an echo. It's such a depressed post-industrial center that it's just completely gone. We don't have echoes of it the way Northampton still does, which is kind of the sister city in footwear making in England.
We're going to get to all that. Two quick sidebars. One, we've been trying to get Randy on the show for a little bit. I think he would be incredibly interesting to talk to. And I'm going to send this to him whenever it comes out.
I apply for grant after grant to try to get myself out there to talk to him and overlap this circle of knowledge.
He's not the easiest guy to track down, which is exactly what I love about it. But we're very much working on it. I think this will help. Shout out Randy Merrill. The lineage in general, right? Like, you have to learn from somebody. And they're like, you know, over in Europe, there are kind of a few schools, right? In Florence and the Stefano Bemer School and a couple others. But really, the cowboy boot, Western boot making is kind of the most fascinating to me. Basically, everybody can trace their family tree back to some of the originals, right? Like, It's really incredible. Talked with Lisa Sorrell about this a bunch, and Graham Ebner, I think, even more on both of their episodes. You can learn a lot just in general from books. Like, the internet is incredibly helpful to people, but there are those little things that can kind of only be handed down. You know, I don't know if we call them like secret tricks or whatever, but the things that you can't even necessarily name or write in a book. Like, I don't even understand it. I'm not a bootmaker, but I know from talking to others that it's true. And maybe it's just kind of like a feeling or a way of doing things, or even the progression that you take. I mean, is that something that you can shed a little bit of light on in your family tree?
It's absolutely true. So I never got to meet Ed Martin, and I've seen pictures of his boots, and I can see my own work in pictures of boots that were made 40 years ago. It's really a nuanced artistry, exactly what you're saying, like a passing on of technique. And there's so many complex steps that go into making a boot. So I'm not sure, I can't say, oh, I cut my counter this way, and that's what resulted in this contour profile that I can identify looking in this other thing. And I try to keep those things in mind when I look at Massachusetts footwear making history, because I'm really looking at objects and stories and archives, and looking at a boot as an object, not as just a beautiful thing or a well-made thing, but what can we see when we look at these things that you can trace knowledge in? It's just so far removed from how we think about things, in the way that I can recognize in my own boots a lineage that goes back to Ed, which I'm sure goes back to his dad. I think that's where he learned, in his bootmaking shop. And Jim told me there were some German bootmakers that worked in that shop. So it's this oral history that also kind of got broken. I know there are people like Lisa and Lee Miller and Western bootmakers who knew a lot of the characters at play over the last 100 years or so. And they're tracing these lineages and trying to save these histories and stories in a oral tradition or a written tradition that's new. But looking at objects to try to trace histories is something that I really like, the idea of that you can think of not the thing itself, but the know-how that went behind it as something that you could recognize and trace. Because we have all kinds of shoemakers and footwear makers that don't have their histories recorded. Western bootmaking was good at that. Shoemaking in the United States, not so much. And certainly not most of the stories of women who worked in footwear making, who had an enormous role in it. And those stories still aren't being told today.
Do you think that this mystery of the lineage, which certainly involves technique, right, and process and all that, but I think you just kind of said, if I got it right, that you can look and you can see these old boots from 40 years ago, and you can see your work in them and the other way around, but you can't even necessarily put a finger on it. Like, how do you detach that from the object, the training itself, maybe, and share it? Is it possible?
I don't know. I don't know if it is. I'm somebody who does whatever it is I'm doing. I do it because I feel like I have to. I'm compelled and kind of had a gut feeling that this is what you need to do right now. And then I analyze the hell out of things after the fact. And it could be 20 years before I figure something out, but it could be like 3 weeks from now. I'm like, oh, this connection. I always call it the puzzle pieces. The puzzle pieces are falling into place. I don't know. To answer that question, it's really hard, right? Like, if you're pulling a boot from the 1800s out of a box and looking at it, maybe you can't trace that to something that's happening now. Maybe it did die out. Part of the research has taken me into these newspaper ads for people who were enslaved and ran away. Oh, and God. Some of them, I know, some were like in Salem. There was this guy named Tom Brown, and he ran away, and it was the late 1700s. So right before the beginning of this kind of systemic artisan work happened in 10 footers. But he ran away, and this ad says he's dressed this way and he has his bag of shoemaking tools and he's a trained shoemaker. That story just ends there. Could we trace Tom's knowledge through time? Like, these things actually are happening. He could have taught somebody, and we don't have those histories. And I don't have the answer for that. I certainly can't say this boot went from this person to this person to this person, which makes it all the more important, the work that Lisa's doing right now, or that Lee's doing, or anyone else who's Dina McGuffin, like people who can tie all the techniques and material knowledge together. I don't know. This is what thrills me, keeps me up at night.
Keep working on it. Kind of backing up where we were in your story, had you felt like you had become a bootmaker yet, or what was the progression from there?
So I really knew nothing about bootmaking either. I have no cultural tie to it. And in fact, when I started learning with Jim, he kept saying he became a bootmaker because he loved cowboy boots. And I didn't know what he meant by that. That's how far growing up in Boston area, and my dad's from France, so, and he's the only one who came here. So most of my, all of my family on my dad's side is in France. So I'm between Paris and Boston, which have just zero relationship to Western boots. I didn't understand what he meant by that. I didn't know that there was this bootmaking culture, people that love them. I didn't know the history. I didn't know it anything more than a very superficial understanding of kind of the iconography of the cowboy boot as representing America, representing the West and individualism, and something I had no relationship to. In my mind, he's the only hand-making footwear professional in Massachusetts. He was willing to train me. I would learn these skills and then make shoes. I didn't understand until I was deep in it what a huge ask that it had been of him to teach me these things. I didn't understand that shoemaking and bootmaking are really different beasts. And after 3 years of training with him, I could make cowboy boots, but not really well to what I consider well. So, you know, I still have years and years ahead of me of practice at that point. And I'm a mom. I have three kids. Best case scenario, I'm doing bootmaking part-time for years and years at that point. I thought, okay, I have a decision to make here. Either I go back to shoemaking because I've learned the skills of how to do that and I can apply some of these skills. And then what's kind of the end result of that? I actually like the process of bootmaking better than shoemaking from what I had learned in England. I liked the permanence of it, the hardiness of it. I like that it was unisex in a way. I like that there was an integrity of materials, like your counters are exposed. That's the structural piece around the heel. Whereas in shoemaking, they generally have lining over them that always rubs away. And this was like a good design solution to me coming from an architectural background, which was really heavily influenced by Bauhaus ideals and integrities. And everything that I saw in cowboy boots was espousing these principles without them probably even being aware of it. The people that had developed these things back in the late 1800s when the cowboy boot came to be. And you can make money at it, right? People are willing to spend really big amounts of money for handmade cowboy boots, and they're very expensive. So I just made that decision then. I'm going to dedicate myself to this practice, to doing this, to getting better. I only have so many hours in my life, so I need to dedicate it to one thing. That's the decision I made. And then I just love it. Every day, no matter what I'm doing on the boots, it's such a good way to live and it's such a good way to be. And after that, I discovered the community of bootmakers and I've discovered the culture and I just have such a deep respect for it. And in the beginning, felt on the outside, but through this kind of research and digging into all the histories, which happened accidentally for me here in Massachusetts, I found out that there isn't really this disconnect that people think of. When I say I'm a cowboy boot maker in Massachusetts, I always get the weird look or a laugh or why and how did that happen? And they are so intimately connected through our histories and our practices and the developments in footwear, machinery, and how that influenced and developed cowboy boot making. That makes a much more thrilling and enriched practice for me as well, placing myself, placing artists and labor within all these larger stories and healing that disconnect.
Keep healing. You alluded to the fact that shoemaking and bootmaking are quite different. Talking with Lisa, she said the same thing. It was like one of the first things she says in the episode. It's like, what are you wearing? She's like, I made these shoes. The great Lisa Sorrell had no idea how to make shoes. I found it basically impossible. So I started working on it because I wanted to figure it out after decades of being this person who is pretty good at making boots. Can you keep going on that a little bit? You mentioned the purpose and the counter. I think there's a kind of philosophical part of that and a technical one. What else is different about them?
So I make cowboy boots, a classic cowboy boot that is a side seam construction boot made out of four basic components, like two top pieces and then the counter, the heel piece, and the vamp, the fore part. What's so ingenious about the history of how cowboy boot design and pattern making and construction developed was that this template system sort of developed and then was also passed down from maker to maker in lineages that is based on the same kind of principles that go behind shoemaking, pattern making. But shoemaking, pattern making still is in this very technical set of processes that comes off the last. So you're taking the last and creating a set of patterns and they go together, the closing, the way that the upper pieces are all sewn, go together in a specific way with different allowances for the seams and the joints. And it's just a different technical process. It's very closely related to bootmaking, but bootmaking developed this other system that you're certainly, I don't want to say a better bootmaker because that's not true, but you're certainly a bootmaker that has another set of tools in your toolkit if you know how to do that pattern making, but it's not necessarily something you have to know how to do. The processes of doing it, of creating from the beginning, the last work to the patterns, to the clicking, the cutting out of the pattern pieces from raw materials and leather, putting it all together, closing, sewing it together, then lasting and bottoming and putting the boot, all those components together to form a boot are related to what you do in shoemaking, but the processes of doing it are quite different. I made myself a pair of shoes during the really long days and months of the pandemic lockdown because I just wanted a pair of shoes to wear and exhibit for myself and keep longhand. And I actually disliked doing it. I was like, boy, I've been making boots long enough that I don't like shoemaking anymore. And I'm probably not going to do this for a while.
Because it just didn't feel right?
Yeah, just the processes. It wasn't satisfying. And that's just for me. I often say things that are observations on larger systems or larger processes or theories, and then I inevitably insult a whole bunch of people. It's for me. I didn't enjoy doing it. And if I enjoyed making an Oxford, I'd be making Oxfords right now. So it's really about the making. It's not about a judgment on how these different systems or processes or techniques are executed. Just I like making the cowboy boots.
I think that's fair. Something that I imagine that you did like making, and all of your work is absolutely fabulous, and just everybody go to, you're totally going to spell this right after I pronounce it correctly, saboteurs.com. I got it.
Yeah.
Wait till next time. We'll link it in the show notes and on the website. So everybody go take a look at everything, but I believe you call them the Ivy boots that you made a few years ago. Picking one as an example of your work that I think would be really fun to explore for a minute. Can you tell me a little bit about those? Because they are cool.
Sure. That was a client order, and she wanted a pair of boots that felt like ivy had grown up out of the ground and all over her legs. I love this concept because coming from an architecture background, the correlations between architecture of buildings and boots are very close. Boots are a much smaller scale of architecture. Both things, like a building requires basic requirements of shelter, and then you have all the richness that goes into architecture on top of that, of design and space and experience. And then boots have this very basic function of having to protect your feet from the elements, and then have this vast world of design and character and all the things that go into boots. So I started thinking about if a boot were a building, the way ivy grows over buildings and out in nature, what paths would the vines take? And looking at the structure of the side seams of a boot and the kind of the shelf of the spur shelf in the sole, and how would vines travel across it, and started doing these studies of placing mock-ups out in the marsh behind my shop and envisioning plants growing. And so the design really came through in a different process. And typically you would lay down pieces and draw in flowers or ivy or something like that. Like, this reminded me of art school, this order. The way she framed it put me in the mindset of tackling it like a design problem that I had in art school, which I found thrilling. As I priced the boots for her for how much labor this would take, because I proposed hand embroidering all these goat kid leather leaves and then doing them as overlay on the boots, because that would be, to my mind, more authentic design than doing inlay, which is typical, where you're cutting out the holes and negatives.
Like authentic to ivy itself?
Yeah, that their piece is growing on the outside.
That's what it looks like.
She was on board. She was like, yes, you know, I want that and I can afford it. So do what you do. It took a really long time to hand embroider. There were like 80 leaves or something. And it happened to be during spring and summer, and my sons played baseball. So I spent every baseball game embroidering these leaves with silk thread because it catches the light in a different way than nylon does. And then overlaying them onto the boots. And there was a gold metal, like an actual metal covered silk thread for the vines. And they're wedged into the cracks of the side seams the way that ivy really wedges into the cracks of bricks and things. and she loves them. She's such a great, she's a really good client of mine. And she sends me these little notes that says, I'm wearing my Ivy boots today and I've already gotten 3 comments on them. And I feel like I'm swishing through Ivy and thank you so much. And it's such a thrill to wear these boots. And it's a really great relationship to have with a client that affords you the opportunity to work this way.
I love that she's actually out there wearing these things because it doesn't always happen.
She rides public transportation too. So it's really great to get her feedback from the things people say to her while she's on the bus or the subway.
Yeah. How else are you going to get the compliments?
Yeah.
Not in your own car. Wait, so you were making these things at the ballpark?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. One day the wind swept up and it swept like 5 or 6 of these leaves off my lap and they totally blended in with the grass. So I was like running around picking leaves out of the grass. And another time I forgot the pouch on the bleachers and I had like all of Little League looking for this pouch for me. I'm like, it's like 130 hours of work in the pouch. And I got it back. All was good.
My mom was a teacher for decades and she had all these theories on, and she's a huge sports fan, which sports were best to watch on TV while grading papers. Like football is great because you get like, 35, 40 seconds in between and then commercials, and baseball, you can kind of do whatever you want. Basketball is tough, but like you've taken it to a very different level than my mom because you're actually at the game.
I have 3 kids, so there's a lot, and all played sports. So there's a lot of time in mothering at sporting events. And this is no small thing too. This is part of the larger picture. And why I work in a 10-footer was because as a mother at home caring for my kids, I had to figure out, it's a problem to solve, right? How to execute your craft and be there and be flexible time-wise for your children, especially small children where you have to physically be there and be watching them and seamlessly work in all this kind of stuff. So for me, the boot making in that sense was perfect because I could portably take these little bits that I'm hand embroidering that I always incorporate in the elements of my tops to a hockey rink or to the baseball field. You know, that's part of the larger story too, because the early shoemakers, 70% of the shoes were made by women who were working in their kitchens and working in their homes. And I'm part of that lineage too now.
I got one more because you keep nodding at what like the whole second half is going to be of this episode, which is defining what a 10-footer is and that lineage and this incredible history of Massachusetts shoemaking, which you understand deeply and study to this day. But there's one more boot that I want to talk about, and then we'll take a break, and then we're going to get to all that. This is from the Beetle Boots description on your site. And I quote, "The design of these boots came from a subconscious attempt to express the barriers that arise between a mother and daughter during the teenage years." And I think you made them for your daughter. I'd say there's like a real depth to how you see just a pair of shoes, right?
Yeah, maybe. In my mind, I separate boots that are made for someone as an order, even not as an order, as a gift, or you're making for somebody. And then work that I make that I feel like I have to, that in my mind become an art piece. Not necessarily that the thing at the end is the art piece and the end goal, but rather the process of doing it was what I had to do because it's how I work through life. It's how I share my experiences. And it is a very difficult experience, is being a mother of teenagers in general, but a mother of a teenage girl who very often asserts her independence by putting up these kind of invisible barriers and pulling away. And it's absolutely part of nature and something that needs to happen, but it's a painful part of nature from my point of view. So I made these boots for my daughter, and that doesn't necessarily mean what it sounds like because she has never worn them, probably never, will never wear them. I hope maybe someday, but she doesn't need to.
You know what? As I believe I read on the site, these are cemented construction. So it seems like you skipped all the appropriate steps in this case.
They're still whip stitched on the inside. So there's quite a bit of sewing that you don't see. But yeah, the soles are not sewn on. At the time, it was one of those things that I was like, this makes absolutely no logical sense to be working on these, because I had several orders, paying orders. I needed to work on them. I enjoyed working on them. And I just kept leaving them to work on these other boots that were for her, who I knew at the time she wouldn't wear because she was vegan and would not wear leather boots. I had to do it. I can't explain it otherwise. I felt compelled to do it. She did put them on and model them for me with my photographer. And it wasn't until the photographer asked her to do this one shot for like fashion shots, sort of, which I had never done before, that I understood that that's what they were about. This whole like expressing the pain of this experience of the past few years. I never even got these photographs. I don't think they came out great or something. And I don't need to see them because I experienced the moment. But the photographer asked her to get on her stomach and crawl under a bed. So you know how when you do that, your legs are kind of splayed like a frog's and you see the boots. And she was trying all these different scenarios to see what came out looking good. And when she did that and got on her stomach, you saw the soles of the boots. And it hit me that they were some ways inspired by these beetle markings of a really huge beetle that's like as big as your hand. On a beetle, you have this exoskeleton that's really protecting it, right? And then maybe on the stomach, it's the vulnerable part. But humans have the really hard part on the bottom of our soles, right? That's what all these boot companies are trying to figure out, how to make the soles impenetrable by nails or something. We're protecting ourselves from the ground, but we're vulnerable on the top. The top parts of our feet are vulnerable. And here, when she was upside down, it hit me like, okay, she had made herself impenetrable by building this invisible barrier. And then I'm expressing it through making these boots.
So she appreciates them, maybe.
I don't think she understands it yet.
But I think that's okay.
Normal. Yeah.
Here's my quick counter story to that. One time I was walking in the dark through like one of those little parks in between streets in New York City, stepped on board, I guess, or something that had a rusty nail in it, and it plunged through my shoe and into my foot, and it really hurt, and I had to get a tetanus shot, and I was wearing mass-produced sneakers, so they didn't even care about me.
I wore sneakers in my shop most of the time because I ruptured ligaments in my shoe, and they're just filled with the tacks. Every once in a while, I get my nail puller out and pull all the tacks out of my sneakers.
Yeah, you could still like slip on them, you know? Like they can't offer tremendous grip. Okay, okay. Look, let's take a quick break and then, yeah, get into all sorts of historical stuff. We'll be right back with Sarah on the ShoeCast. All right, Sarah, I need to ask you some of the toughest questions ever asked of anyone. It's time for Jen Facts. Jen works at Standard & Strange and fancies himself quite clever. He has provided us with three facts, only one of which is actually true. I'll read all three, and at the end of the episode, you'll have to guess which is correct before we reveal the true Jen fact. Of course, this is a Massachusetts shoemaking-themed batch here. You ready?
Yep.
All right, Jen fact number one. Massachusetts' first documented shoemaker, Harlan Pennyweather, was most famous for his unique shoe style called the Dover, named for the town in which he lived, which Massachusetts famed shoe manufacturer Alden much later named one of their most longstanding patterns after. Gen fact number two, while 10 footers, which we will define and describe in detail coming up in the second half, were the most common shoemaking workshop structure in the 19th century Massachusetts shoemaking world, a number of smaller shoemakers operated out of a building type called a quarter house, which was one quarter the size of a 10-footer, and were strictly used for upper closing. Gen fact number three, Massachusetts was essentially always America's shoemaking capital, even with the advent of industrialization and widely distributed technology that lessened the need for highly skilled craftspeople. That said, Massachusetts still produced 40% of the nation's shoes in the early 20th century. What's the gen fact? We don't know, but we'll find out at the end of the episode. And now, back to the ShoeCast. All right, we're back on the ShoeCast with Sarah Guerin, aka Saboteuse. So good at this. It's hard to figure out how you have time to make any of these boots between, you know, the baseball games and just spending an incredible amount of time researching and learning about Massachusetts shoemaking history. Where did that all begin for you?
It began with my own workshop. I did not know anything about the shoemaking history. My husband built me a small workshop in the back of our yard because I'd been working in our walkout basement area this was a gift to me, this shop, but I really also needed to psychologically get out of the house since I was home with the kids all the time and then working in the house on my boots and things. He built the shop and I happened to also be a zoning nerd and I was on the planning board of our town and know that this was a zoning violation to have a workshop that's not attached to your house. I don't live in a place that anybody's going to come knocking down the door and say, you know, you can't work there and nobody's going to shut down my cowboy boot making back there. But I started thinking that this is on principle wrong. You should be able to support art in a urban zoning context. This is how we form our societies. This is in the United States anyway. This is how we say this is what we value in places. And I knew that there was a small shoemaking workshop preserved at the Lynn Museum. And that's all I knew. I didn't know anything more about it. So I called them and said, can you tell me about this shop? Because I'm going to try to rewrite our zoning bylaws. And I need to start interviewing artists who work in different workshops at different places and make a defense of why I want to change the zoning in my town, which is a quite difficult thing to do. They pointed me toward their archives, which are held at the Phillips Library. That's a very well-known library outside of Boston. That's how it started. I have never stopped since then. And I started learning about these shoemaking workshops. I started learning about the systems of handmaking and the evolution toward machine making and how unstatic a story that is and how wonderful these workshops were. And I started learning more and more about the shoemakers of the time and finding an affinity to them. I started finding out that we use the same tools, which I didn't know, and that this cowboy boot making practice that I had starting, you know, I was a couple of years into it at this point, but really starting was deeply tied to this place, whereas I thought that it wasn't. And I didn't know about Massachusetts footwear making history. And when I started seeing how important it was and how important it was in the long haul from the early handmade days to the mass produced days, I felt like this story needed to be told and that I am a part of it. And I'm understanding my practice every day by the more and more that I learn. I rewrote the zoning bylaws. In fact, we have like, I don't know, 10 pages of zoning bylaws in our town, and two of them are just about having an art and craft studio in your yard. Like it's ridiculously overwritten zoning language, but it sends the message out that this is something of value and it's something important and something that we support in this place. And it's tied to a history and a lineage of production that was globally important.
I'm so excited for the bonus zoning law episode that doesn't even have to do with your workshop. It'll be about 5 hours long and everybody's going to love it.
It will talk about accessory use.
And so this is the 10 footer, right?
Like yes.
You replicated a 10 footer. What is for you? And back in the day, what was a 10 footer? Was there more than one?
Wherever humans are, people need shoes. And I like to give that disclaimer because I talk about the importance of Massachusetts footwear making history and my place in it now. But I don't want to say that we're Shoe City. This is the only place this happened. Like every place that I travel to in Massachusetts to look into their archives and libraries, it's the same story everywhere. And it's kind of like this point of pride and a tribalism that I don't think serves anyone. We are all part of a larger story of footwear production. But something very unique happened in and around the North Shore of Boston in the early 1800s that ended up defining this place as an important focus of footwear that had global implications. The 10 footer was the typical footwear making workshop of the early 1800s. Like 1810 to 1860 is the time that they were the typical shoemaking space. And 1830 is probably their heyday. Of course, it's not static. So there are transitional periods, and it depends on which town and how far it was away from Lynn, which was really kind of the center where everything came out of. If you broke down shoemaking or footwear making into four overall practices, like you have the glass making with pattern making as process one, pattern and design. Process two would be clicking, cutting out the pieces. Process three is closing. And all these things would be separated in a school or in a factory now. Only making was happening in the 10 footers. This was something I didn't understand going into this research. I'm thinking like the shoemakers in these spaces made a shoe from A to Z in these spaces. And this is what I want to do. And I'm saying this is a thing of value. And that when we moved into factories, we separated those processes and we lost the knowledge of how to do that, because now you're only learning how to do heels or shanks or something. But I didn't understand that 3/4 of that process up to making was happening inside homes, and it was all women. It was extremely gender defined labor. And then men were doing the making, which is taking those uppers and attaching them to the insole and bottoming them and turning them into shoes. And they were workspaces. They did not receive the public. So you had these small buildings. A 10-footer is generally 12 by 12. You had like 200 to 300 in each town all around Greater Boston. So there were tons of shoemakers. And because there were so many shoemakers here, they were attracting shoemakers as immigrants. There was this steady, significant influx of immigrants coming from Europe to work here in shoemaking.
Do you know which countries?
Italy was the biggest one. Ireland, there were several Irish shoemakers, but they came in waves to Boston in different times and not just for shoemaking, but many shoemakers were coming. It was like a sophisticated system of working all together. It wasn't a shoemaker working in one spot in one building and having an apprentice and a couple journeymen. Different people owned the buildings. You rented the spots like Burse, the way that like a barbershop operates now, like you were paying for your spot. You worked sitting down on those shoemaker benches, those seats or berths all day. So there were no tables in there. You didn't move around the shop. That's why they were such small buildings. The buildings themselves were valuable and moved from site to site, depending on who owned the building and who was renting them out and who inherited a building when somebody died. It wasn't so much a cottage industry in the way we understand it as a really complicated system of collaborative work that produced a lot of shoes. So even in this 10-footer time where it's all handmade, records show that like one family of shoemakers, including men and women and teenagers, were making 10,000 pairs a year.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. I have so many questions. First, who was orchestrating all of this? Was there some like larger body sitting on top of it and saying, you know, we need uppers from here and the leather's being delivered to you? Or like, was everybody more on their own? Or like, how did this even all function to get to 10,000 pairs from one family? Like, and they're not even doing the whole thing themselves.
Well, that's kind of what I mean about like this unique moment in time happened. So people jumped into the story really quickly. Like, how can I make money at this? How can I change it? How can I make it faster and more efficient? And that's why these developments in early machinery, mechanical machinery, you know, and then quickly developing into much bigger and better machinery. United Shoe Machine Corps, 1899, formed when three companies, I think it was Goodyear, McKay, and there were two McKay companies, joined together and made this machine producing company also on the North Shore in Beverly. The tanneries were in Woburn, and it was this system that was just seemed to be happening. It was like this organism that just grew and pulsed and grew and pulsed in this place. And again, not to belittle or not to emphasize the fact that there weren't shoes and boots being made everywhere that people lived, but something just happened here where these innovative developments in how to produce shoes at a bigger and bigger and bigger scale happened here and then were exported and sent away. Like British United Shoe Machine Corps was a subsidiary of USMC here. And we still think of that Northampton and these centers of shoemaking in England as being these powerhouses, which they certainly were, but they were sort of like pulled like taffy away from Lynn and then situated there and then working back and forth between each other. It was just this phenomenon that happened here. And a lot of textile mills were also happening in Massachusetts, like further towards the center of the state. The developments in architecture, developments in machinery, developments in labor practices, in societal understanding and hierarchies of craft and industry and innovation, we're all interconnected. And these are the puzzle pieces I'm trying to put together.
Man, yeah. And it makes so much sense, obviously, especially once Goodyear and McKay, and they're developing these machines and you can make a billion shoes and all this money flows into it, that there's like coordination. The fact that it was happening in some organic, as you put it, quite wonderfully coordinated way before that is incredible. And then, yeah, like a lot of this stuff was being exported, right? Kind of shoemaking capital of the world, dare we say, or at least for this kind of footwear. You know what kind of shoes are we talking about here?
Well, it depended on the place, because Massachusetts, it's a pretty close, small, dense place. So even in these towns, which Stoneham, Haverhill, Lynn are all on the North Shore, Brockton's on the South Shore, Boston, all of these places are within a half hour, 45 minutes of each other. And they quickly specialized into boot making, children and women's everyday shoemaking, women's fancy shoemaking. You know, they became centers that specialize in places. Now I spend time in historical societies and museums looking at shoemaking tools at all these places. And it's really quite thrilling to find how different the shoemaking tools are in, say, West Newbury, which is just a little bit farther away. It's like this little slight geographical isolation from the rest of these centers produced an entirely different type of practice longer because they didn't change as quickly as the city centers were changing. Even in those early days where most of the shoe was being produced by hand, we were exporting shoes to London and Paris. And there are overlaps with fashion historians at these museums and that I talk to that are really focusing on just fashion and the shoes being produced as opposed to the methods and techniques that I really focus on, who talk about the significance in that way. Dare you say, yes, say we were exporting to other places in the world because we just made so many shoes.
So cool.
Yeah, it is. But there's something about the United States, you know, I think part of it's because we're such a young country that it burst like an ember just exploding into flame that dies out. Whereas you have these much older, well-established places like England and Italy and Portugal that absolutely the craft and hand making shoes were affected by mass production, but they didn't quite explode and die out the way the U.S. shoe hand shoemaking or high-end bespoke making did.
Slightly less capitalistic societies, maybe.
Maybe more just embedded in tradition and the one holdout that isn't going to give up because they've been there 600 years. We think of this as ancient history. I've given public demonstrations in Lynn, and I usually do it outside if the weather's nice in front of their 10-footer at the Lynn Museum. And an old man who lives in senior housing in these big old converted shoe factories right next door came down because he saw me in the courtyard and started talking to me. And it turned out his grandfather had a 10-footer that's in one of these 1899 newspaper articles that I happen to have copies of there to talk to people about history. And he started crying because he didn't know this drawing of his grandfather's shop was there with a full story of who worked in the shop and when. He's living now, and this was his grandfather. And this was not ancient, ancient times. We're only 3 or 4 generations removed from these shoemakers.
Crazy how fast things move. Do you know why Lynn was the epicenter? Was that like a geographic thing or just kind of happened?
I don't know. You know, it's a small city just north of Boston. Salem is 2 towns away, and it certainly was a much bigger city than Lynn was back then, just because of the maritime industry with Salem. But I don't know if it has something to do with the people that were there. Maybe they were just good at it, and then it started growing. There certainly was an epicenter that was around Lafayette Street and Chatham. There was a shoemaker named Parrott, really like his cousins and his brothers, and they all had 10-footers around there, and it sort of like burst out of there.
Well, I mean, I guess it makes sense that they were close enough to like the seaport, because I mean, I feel like it's always water.
They have a harbor. Lynn is on the water, just south of Salem, kind of between Salem and Boston Harbor. Beverly also has a harbor, and Beverly was really where the machinery was being made. So we were exporting shoes, and then we exported systems of shoemaking. And then when, you know, the USMC closed in 1997, and I was an architecture student then, and I came up to like just with my architecture nerdy friends, and we broke into the buildings to take pictures because they're these massively scaled, impressive buildings. I am only recently, through this constant practice of making and thinking and researching, realizing that we exported these systems that developed that really were mostly based on gendered labor that was underpaid. And then when we exported the USMC company, we were exporting a system of Sidney Winslow, who established the company, making the equivalent of billions in his time off of Black invented innovation and machines, where those families did not get that money. And we exported really complicated ideas of footwear making, along with the actual things and the machines and how to do it. There's this really great book called Footwork, What Your Shoes Tell You About Globalization, that Tansy Hoskins wrote. And I heard her on a BBC podcast. And she talks and she cites it. It's kind of an academic piece that she wrote as a book in just after COVID-19 about how 80% of the footwear industry in the world now is still women who are underpaid, and that the wealth at the top, it cannot be divorced from the hardship at the bottom. And that's something that developed in 1830 in Lynn when it comes to footwear. And it's still that way in 2023.
Jeez. Yeah. I mean, of all the things to kind of stick.
Yeah.
Maybe not the best one.
I don't know. Even those of us who love shoes and just buy them are part of that story. And somebody like me working in a replica 10-footer, it's not just the thing that I'm making, but like the tradition and the history and the knowledge I'm using to do things that I would have been prevented from learning 150 years ago and certainly from doing is part of like an active resistance to those systems. So that comes back full circle to your question about how I see myself as a saboteur.
I think it works. So you've also recently become the footwear artist in residence, a term that everybody knows about, at the Buttonwoods Museum in Haverhill, Mass.
Haverhill.
Haverhill.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, I was on a roll pronouncing stuff, which is abnormal. What does that even mean?
So I do come from this art background, and I think I operate a lot in the, because I was trained as an artist in the world. Art residencies are a really good way, I suppose, for contemporary artists to work with museums. And since I seem to take issue with everything, I also take issue with museums' roles in creating these hierarchies of art, fine art, craft, design over the last 100, 200 years. And that always harms the craft artists. It harms indigenous artists. It harms footwear makers because what we do is seen as lower on a hierarchy, right? And that museums actually have a lot of complicity in this because they elevate certain works to something that is called high art or fine art. So I'm trying to break down those systems as well. And one of the ideas I had was to have footwear artists in residence where you're presenting footwear as an art and a craft. And this museum is a very small local museum in Haverhill, which was a footwear making hub of women's fine dress shoes. They have an enormous amount of hand making tools, but also like early industrial making tools from when some factories were closing and just donating their things to the museum, which is underfunded and understaffed. So a lot of that stuff has just been put into storage. So I got a grant. I fund half my work through grants, artist grants, and I got a grant to make this position myself. And I'm going to try to carry it on when my tenure is over virtually. Like if we can get some of these tools that have been held in trust by museums for a time when people know how to use them again, which is now, into the hands of artisans and share that through social media, through the connectors, technology as connectors now, that we can continue a residency in a way that doesn't have to be in person and kind of repair the harm that museum systems have done to craft artists.
All right.
I told you I could talk all day. You might be sad in the end.
You say a lot of things that once you say them, make an incredible amount of sense. And you're kind of smacking yourself for having gone to a museum and enjoying it, you know? Like, how did I never consider this? I just like the sculpture that some dude made way back, you know?
I make some boots that are art pieces that I would only sell to a museum or I hope get shown in a museum. And I'm part of that problem too, right? That's the way that you feel valid in your artwork. That's the way that you're proving that footwear craft is art. Do we even need these hierarchies? But I'm part of that system too, and reconciling that with the ways that I do things. But I still like desperately hope that a museum will come and buy one of my artworks, because if I don't have them entered in shows, they're just in boxes in my 10-footer under the table, and you know, I could use that space.
Okay, so yeah, it's just all about space. It's yeah. Everybody's life.
So I could sell out too.
So at the Buttonwoods Museum, I mean, what's going on functionally as a footwear artist in residence? Are you working? I know that you kind of have access to this old storehouse of stuff that it seems like has kind of just been sitting there.
Yeah, it's been sitting there. Some of it for 100 years, some of it from the 90s when some of the last factories, shoe factories closed in Haverhill. I think the last one that closed, Haverhill. They literally, it's Haverhill and you don't pronounce the E.
Like my wife is from Massachusetts, like just outside Boston. So it's especially embarrassing. I spent a lot of time up there mispronouncing towns.
We're going to toss the history quiz and just quiz you on the pronunciation of all these town names.
I'd love that.
So in practice, I'm there every Thursday this fall. It was 12 weeks and I go through all the stuff in their storage. They also have a 10-footer preserved on the property, which is the coolest 10-footer. There are like a dozen around Boston and they're becoming friends. I go and spend time with them in different ways and get grants to do different programs at each town and, you know, maybe with school groups and field trips and maybe just going through their shoemaking tool collections and identifying things. But this one in Haverhill is really special because the guy, Daniel Hunkins, whose shop it was, started it in 1859. So this is like when everybody was leaving these and moving into factories. He's like the Western bootmaker, the one who's doing it different, the one who says, like, I'm going to fix shoes, but I'm also going to be making bespoke shoes. I'm going to be doing orthopedic work. And he put an addition on. So his 12 by 12 shop, he put like a 3-foot addition on the end and made it a public welcoming space. He put a bench in. None of these 10 footers ever really accepted the public in any way or welcomed the public from all of the diaries that I've read and account books. And here he made a space and it's still preserved that way. He put beadboard around it to make it look nice. And he did it differently and he did it well. And he kept records and we have all of them there. To me, I love it because it shows the innovation of footwear makers. There's something about all of us that we all have the same qualities. Like during the pandemic, they were doing that independent shoemaker conference in England. They did it on Zoom for the first time. And all the shoemakers were given sort of a set of questions. Like, and one of them was like, if you weren't a shoemaker, what would you have done? Like to a T, all of them said architect. And I just find it weird that I kind of came through the circuitous architecture route. But then maybe not so weird. Maybe we just have this quality that you're drawn to working with your hands at a certain scale on something very architectural.
Yeah, if everybody's doing it, it is by definition not weird.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
What have you found there? Like, what's your favorite find from tools, machinery, whatever?
So far, my favorite find is this mechanical hand cranking cast iron tool that looks like a 5-in-1, which is a big cutting tool for heavy veg tan leather, but it's clearly not a 5-in-1. It almost looks like something from a Tim Burton movie that you would take a 5-in-1 and add legs and it could start walking away on its own. And it took me a while to find out what it was. And I was going on these forums, you know, Facebook forums and groups that's posting pictures saying, can anybody tell what this is? And I have a pretty good deductive mind and I've seen a lot of tools and I couldn't figure out what it was. And it turns out that it is the machine that would put the brass banding around the edge of pattern pieces. Because a lot of the old pattern pieces that you would cut the vamp out of or the counter out of the big sheet of leather, you were doing it by hand at first with a knife. And if you did that around cardboard or wood, it would damage and nick the pieces. And, you know, over time, the pieces would no longer be very accurate. So they put this metal banding around the edge to make it hardy. And you could just run your knife around the metal banding. And that's where the term clicking came from, because of the clicking sounds of the knife against these metal bands. And this machine is the machine that put the banding on the pattern pieces. And I've never seen one. And I've only found one other picture of it. And it was made in Boston by a company called the Hartman Brothers, I think. It's just super cool.
Can people see this? Like, you have a secondary Instagram account for the artisan residence. Is that right?
Yes. I started a Buttonwoods Fair account that I'm hoping will then become that virtual way of people, like, say, one of the 35 peg marking wheels that they have, like, makes it into the hands of a bootmaker somewhere far away. They would have access to the Instagram account to also post about it. That's my hope, that it would continue in a larger ballooned way of people contributing to the active practice of continuing the lives of these tools and our skills.
We'll link to your site, Instagram, and this one too. It's really cool. I mean, it's just even the setting in the photos, it feels really old.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Keep it up. I love the bigger vision on it too, which I didn't realize.
So Haverhill's having this. It's also a kind of depressed post-industrial city that's going through a renaissance, for lack of a better word. And Historic New England owns some old shoemaking buildings called the Burgess and Lang buildings there and have bought some other properties. And they're starting this long-term, large-scale cultural center that will have, hopefully, a shoe museum or maker spaces, or really, like, highlight footwear and Massachusetts' importance of footwear craft and shoes in ways that haven't been done before. They have a collection in these buildings of, like, 22,000 shoes, and I was only the second person to ever ask to see them, according to their curator. And I wanted to look at old side seam boots to see the legacy of the boots that I make now in New England. So good things to come in Haverhill soon, we hope.
Well, keep it up. You told me a bit back that you've been teaching third graders, I think, about shoemaking.
I'm like the field trip person. I'm not teaching in the way that...
They come to you.
No, sometimes I go to the schools. Sometimes I go to the Stoneham Historical Society or the Lynn Museum, and then the school groups have their field trip there, and I'll be like one station on the field trip where they go from room to room learning different things, and I show them how a really abbreviated version of how boots are made. I know the things that kids like and keep their attention just from having been around kids for so long. The deer leg bone or the bristles coming from a wild boar's back, like those are the kind of things that grab their attention. And then just tell them a little bit about, you know, you live in a place where shoemaking was really important and you should look at your shoes and think about who's making them. Look at your Crocs and your sneakers and think about how are they different.
Do you think it's making an impact?
Yeah, I do. Probably not all across the board, but if I see three groups in one day, there's always like one. We make the eye contact and I know that that kid is going to walk away and not forget that day. Like you can just tell when those moments happen. I had the coolest experience this summer being an exhibitor at the Lowell Folk Fest. So they have a little corner of this big kind of music and cultural festival in Lowell, Mass, which was a big textile center. I had a table and people came in the hundreds and hundreds. So I had never had so many people to talk to over a 2-day period about all this stuff. And there was this one kid, he had to have been like no more than 7 or 8. And he came up to the table and started asking me questions about Lass. I had demo pieces with like a half done insole with the holdfast made and some uppers that were unattached. And he was forming the connections in real time and asking the kind of questions that I've never seen anybody ask, because it is really complicated how to make a shoe or a boot. And his mom kept apologizing and saying like, oh, come on, let's move on, honey. And I was like, no, stay. I want to talk. And he would say, okay, well, if you're using the nails to hold the upper, then how are you pulling apart to sew? Do you pull all the nails out or do you pull one at a time? Like he was figuring it out as I was explaining with props and then asking questions 3 steps ahead in a way where he had already figured it out. And I felt like that's the one. He's going to grow up and solve all our problem systems. Or this little girl in Stoneham who was, you know, a third grader, and she had a mask on and she had really thick bangs that came down, so all you could see were her little eyes, and she was just riveted and asked me so many good questions. When I was in third grade, I didn't know that you could be a shoemaker. So already that's like hundreds of kids that do now.
I want to get these kids on the podcast. All right, 2 more. This one's kind of the big one. You said, I forget if we were talking or I read it somewhere, that you're hellbent on this, obviously, education around shoes and what great shoes can mean and the history of it and breaking down these systems, being this saboteurs. But buying legitimately handmade boots from someone like you isn't the solution on a mass scale. They're too expensive. And if they weren't too expensive, there wouldn't be nearly enough of them for everybody to have some shoes. Are you getting any closer to what you think might be the bigger answer here?
I think it's through my practice. So the thing that I make at the end isn't the end goal. And I guess that's the difference. When I talk to the third graders and I talk to design students in fashion programs, the people who are going to be out there kind of divorced from making and designing shoes and that will be made by someone else in larger systems. And I'll say to them, you know, I'm not a bootmaker that's working in an old way because it's really impractical. The price point is unachievable for most people. I don't do it in order to solve these problems. The way that I'm doing it is how I think. It's how I translate my experience and how I can come out and talk to you about it and talk to uncurated publics. It might be somebody that's in a public program that has nothing to do with footwear that might be making these connections. To stop siloing all of us into these different worlds, the consumers should know what to be looking for and how to think about solving these problems. Because at one time, we were making shoes on a mass-produced level with intent to repair within these kind of closed systems that yes, had a lot of problems. Like, I don't want to idealize and romanticize the past, both for the makers and for the planet. You know, just look at all the Superfund sites we had to have around Massachusetts from the poisoning from the tanneries. But I'm using techniques and skills specific to handmade footwear as a way to translate my experience in life and relate architecture to craft skills to reinvent how we transfer craft knowledge, because I really think that that connection to making is part of the solution. And I might not have it, but I'm a keeper of knowledge that might have the key for someone else to figure it out.
There's a question that I want to start asking everybody, because somehow almost 100 episodes into this show, I've realized that people who are very deep, you know, dare we say a bit obsessive with something, in this case, and almost always on this show, you know, shoemaking or shoes in some form, boots, whatever, are also into other things very deeply. What is one other thing that you're like, this is my other thing that I care way too much about?
Hand knitting.
All right. Nice.
Yeah. Well, I got obsessively into hand knitting when my kids were really little, because the boot making and it was shoemaking to begin with, was not portable. And it's really difficult to be a hands-on parent and somebody who's creative or has work that they want to do in any way, and not either resent your kids for keeping you away from the work or resent the work from keeping you away from your kids. And knitting solved this problem, because you can get as deep into it as you want to. And I went really deep. I'm a master knitter in the Knitting Guild Association program, and into that history and into those techniques. And I've taught for years at a adult education place, kind of sharing the history of different knitting traditions and, you know, how to not be discouraged from doing it by people who just tell you there's one way of doing things, because there's never only one way. And I kind of moved away from it the more that I did bootmaking, because my hands can only take so much stress.
That's fair.
Yeah.
All right. I think that was a very successful first attempt at the now universal question that we'll ask anybody on this show, even if they just land like a big closing whammy right before it.
I could answer it in other ways too, but you're right. Like, there is an obsession of the moment, let's say, even if that moment is a few years, for certain personality types and people that are drawn to shoes and become really, really into shoes.
You have to be.
Last January, Amara Hark Weber, the shoemaker, curated a show called Handmade in America.
Yep.
At the University of Wisconsin. And I went to the opening, and Elizabeth Semmelhack, the director and curator from the Bata Shoe Museum, was there. And she was just extraordinary. Listening to her talk about every aspect of footwear was a thrill to behold. But something that she pointed out, she talked a lot about gender in the context of heels, like the history of heels, and that coming kind of through a masculine route from equestrian boots and the kings of France into a modern day gendered female power structure. I can't do justice to summing up her stuff, but something that she pointed out about obsessive collecting of shoes was that when men do it, it's seen as very serious, cerebral, responsible, an investment in commodities. And when women do it, they're considered like Imelda Marcos or Carrie Bradshaw in Sex and the City, and that it's emotional with a lack of control. And coming to it as a maker, it was really, you know, I loved shoes and I wanted to make shoes, and realized I couldn't at the level I wanted to make, because women were never going to spend $4,000 on a pair of shoes, because fashion changes too quickly and they're under these pressures, where men could spend $4,000 on a pair of Oxfords and always be in style. But I didn't like making Oxfords. So this was really like an impact of all these competing social dynamics that affected makers and not just obsessive collectors. And cowboy boots really solved that, because men and women equally will spend $10,000 on a pair of cowboy boots. And they're unisex in a certain way that other footwear just never is. And I find that really intriguing. That'll be like, come back to me in 3 years and maybe I'll have more to say on that.
It's on my calendar. Oh, man. Okay. One more thing. We got to reveal this true Gen Fact. To review Gen Fact number one, Harlan Pennyweather inspired Alden's Dover shoe. Gen Fact number two, quarter houses are where the uppers were closed in Massachusetts. Gen Fact number three, Massachusetts made 40% of the U.S.'s shoes in the early 20th century. Sarah, what do you think it is?
Well, I'm going to eliminate number two, because I know that all uppers were closed inside homes with sewing machines and then in these small manufacturing centers, but not quarter houses.
Sounded good.
Number one is really tempting because it's so hyper specific. That name sounds very British. And Dover is on that southwestern side of Boston going towards Middleborough, which I think is where Alden is. So that's a maybe. I don't know that story. And I want to say it's number three because so much of footwear was centered here. But I also know the United States is a really big place and that places in the Midwest and California could just have more space and much larger scaled places than Massachusetts can. So I feel like my Massachusetts centered self wants to say three, but that might be my downfall. But I'm going to say three.
All right, let's check it out. Open up the envelope here. It's number three. Come on, you were always going to get this. You're premier historian of all this.
My sister married a man from California, and he's like, every sentence that comes out of your mouth, it's like, I mean, not me, but we from Massachusetts. It's we think Massachusetts is the center of the world. So I try to keep that in mind.
Well, in the early 20th century, pretty darn close. You know, let's say that there were, I don't know how many states there were in like 1920, but more than three. And they were making 40% of the U.S.'s shoes. So
yeah,
not bad.
Yeah. But Ohio and Missouri had a lot of shoe and boot making, just more space. But yeah, I'll take your word for it.
All right. Huge thanks to Stern & Strange for sponsoring this episode. Check out that Stitch Down Premium Discord. It's a really good place that you will enjoy. But most of all, Sarah, thank you just for being, I don't know, really darn interesting and interested and sharing it all with us today. God, this was great. I absolutely love this whole chat.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right. I'll talk to you in 3 years, apparently.
It's ever evolving. It's the way I live. But the more that I absorb from these museums, from talking to people, from going to things like Stitch Down, which ostensibly didn't have a lot of, as I said before, kind of overlap with what I do, but you just never know. And I get out there and talk to everybody that I can and read everything I can. And I like to see how all these ideas evolve.
Well, I appreciate the heck out of it. We'll talk soon. Let's do it.
Cool. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. That's it for this week. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.